According to the Mayo Clinic website, fibromyalgia is a disorder characterized by widespread musculoskeletal pain accompanied by fatigue, sleep, memory, and mood issues. Doctors aren't sure what causes it, but they think that genetics may be a factor because sometimes in successive generations, members of the family can experience it. They think that often a particular illness or infection will trigger it. Person didn't have the symptoms, and then they get this infection, and then suddenly they experience the symptoms in an ongoing way. And then they also think that sometimes physical or psychological trauma can induce it. There's no cure for fibromyalgia, but some medications can help control. Doctors talk about management of the symptoms more than they talk about cure. There is no cure, as far as they know. Lifestyle changes also help. Sometimes it involves exercise, changes in diet, relaxation, stress management, or stress reduction measures. I bring this up because I want to relate a story that I heard several years ago. I was taking a class on biblical counseling, and we were talking about how health issues sometimes affect our spiritual outlook. And one of the case studies that we talked about was a woman who had fibromyalgia. She had been diagnosed with it by her doctor. And he told her that, you know, there is no cure for this. What we're going to try to do is help you manage your systems, make some lifestyle changes so that you can deal with this. She didn't like that answer, and so she started going to doctors. And she went to one doctor after another. They all told her the same thing. What you have is not a curable condition. I don't remember the number, but I remember when that number was said, I gasped. It's like I couldn't believe it. This woman went to hundreds of doctors, in a vain attempt to find a cure. Everyone told her exactly the same thing. She didn't like the answer. And because of that, she was just miserable. Not only did she suffer from fibromyalgia, she also suffered just from the emotional impact of not letting go of this. That's an easy thing to fall into, not just with fibromyalgia, but with a lot of other health conditions, particularly chronic health conditions. Severe health conditions, sometimes terminal health conditions, can make people despair of finding any kind of joy or meaningful resolve to the issues that they're facing. And it can drive them to this point of almost mania where they feel like, I've got to find something. Well, the text that was just read for us today is, I think, the answer to that. It's one of many biblical texts that we could use, but I want us to talk about this idea of finding joy and strength in the midst of our health issues. I want to talk about finding joy and strength in the midst of bad health. We're going to take our study from 2 Corinthians chapter 12, verses 1 through 10. This is a continuation of our study of our theme for this year, the joy of the Lord is your strength. That's what the elders settled on here a couple months ago. We've already had an introductory lesson to that, but it's based on the text of Nehemiah chapter 8, verse 10. He said to them, "Go and eat of the fat, drink of the sweet, and send portions to him who has nothing prepared. For this day is holy to our Lord. Do not be grieved. For the joy of the Lord is your strength." And as we talked about, I talked about that poster that we have put up in several places in the building, the artwork that I have on my PowerPoint. I think that most of us struggle the most with joy and weakness and strength in the midst of the storms of life. That's why those storms are pictured on those posters. Just to remind us that it's really in those places when God's joy is most readily found, and where God's strength is most readily available. When we have no resources left, that's when we learn to rely on God. That is where we learn to find this joy that we as Christians, we as the people of God, are supposed to have. And a particular issue that comes up from time to time is how health relates to that. Your health may truly indeed be a fleshly matter, a part of your physical makeup. But everything we experience in life has the potential for becoming a spiritual issue. If you let that thing control you, it will affect your spiritual outlook as well. So I want us to look at how Paul dealt with this particular issue in 2 Corinthians chapter 12. Paul does two comparisons here in 2 Corinthians. First, there's a comparison with him and Moses in chapter 3. In chapter 3, he compares his ministry to Moses. He says that ultimately his ministry is more glorious than that of Moses, not because Moses was a bad person, not because Moses was inept, not because what he had was unimportant, but simply because Paul is a minister of the Lord. He's a minister of God's grace. He's a minister of the reconciliation that comes between God and man on the basis of what Jesus Christ did. So Paul starts out by trying to establish the importance of what he did as an apostle. And then toward the end of the book, in chapters 10 through 13, he does another comparison, which is actually a contrast, between his ministry and those of his critics in the city of Corinth. 2 Corinthians is really a defense of Paul's apostolic ministry. It is a defense of the fact that, A, he is an apostle, he is a legitimate apostle, and the work that he was doing was authorized by God, and he had the authority to address some of the problems in Corinth. Sometime after he left the city of Corinth, somebody came in and started questioning what Paul was doing. And they were questioning it from a distance. He's not there to defend himself. And one of the things he has to deal with in 2 Corinthians are these accusations that either he ain't much of an apostle or he's not an apostle at all. And really in chapters 10 through 13, that's really where he hammers it. He's been building up to it. He's been dropping hints along the way. But he finally gets to chapter 10 and he just pours out the bucket. He just completely unloads on his detractors. And he offers them one proof after another for what he's doing as an apostle. Our text is part of this. This text is not primarily about health. It's not primarily about physical well-being. It's about Paul's defense of himself as an apostle. And yet, in talking about that, he unfolds this magnificent approach to the kind of suffering that we sometimes endure as his people. So we're going to look then here at 2 Corinthians chapter 12, verses 1 through 10. Let's go back to the text, and he starts out, he tells us three things about this so-called thorn in the flesh. God does three things to Paul, or maybe three things for Paul in this text. The first thing he does is God honored Paul by giving him revelations and visions. He says in the first six verses, "I must go on boasting. Though there is nothing to be gained by it, I will go on to visions and revelations of the Lord. I know a man in Christ who 14 years ago was caught up to the third heaven, whether in the body or out of the body, I do not know, God knows. And I know that this man was caught up into paradise, whether in the body or out of the body, I do not know, God knows. And he heard things that cannot be told, which man may not utter. On behalf of this man, I will boast, but on my own behalf, I will not boast except of my weaknesses. Though if I should wish to boast, I would not be a fool, for I would be speaking the truth. But I refrain from it, so that no one may think more of me than he sees in me or hears from me." Several times he uses the word boast. That's kind of an unusual language. Sometimes the word boast does mean just to brag about something. But I think the real idea behind this word has more to do with what you put your confidence in. And that seems to be the idea that he's talking about here. Some of his opponents were boasting about their qualifications. In fact, if you go back to chapter 11, he talks about these people being false apostles. Back in chapter 11, in verse 13, "For such men are false apostles, deceitful workmen, disguising themselves as apostles of Christ." They had made some fantastic boasts. In fact, I think what's going on here in chapter 12 is some of them had boasted about receiving revelations from God. Paul just says they're liars. They're false apostles. And if you want to boast about revelations and visions, we can do that. He said, "I'd rather not boast. I'd rather not brag about that. In fact, I don't really put my confidence in that." But if you want to put these things side by side, we can do that. And that's this play on the idea of boasting. Paul says, "I'd really rather not do that. If you want to, we can. you want to sit down and compare notes side by side, yes, we can do that. I really don't want to do that. But in saying that he doesn't want to do it, he actually does. He brings up this one particular incident that he says happened 14 years ago. 2 Corinthians was written in the mid-50s, somewhere around 54, 55 A.D., while Paul was in Ephesus on his third preaching journey. Both 1 and 2 Corinthians date to that period. And he says this happened 14 years earlier, so we're talking about at the earliest A.D. 39, maybe A.D. 41, 42. That's a period of Paul's life we really don't know much about. It's before he started going on his preaching journeys. Most likely he was in Tarsus of Cilicia. He's kind of, after his conversion, he kind of disappears for a while, actually for more than a decade. And it appears to be at this time that this particular vision is given to him. He uses two words there in verse 1 of our text. He talks about, verse 1, talks about visions and revelations. Vision has to do with what you see. Revelations is a more broad term. Later in the text, he talks about hearing things that he was not allowed to utter. Revelation is just the broader term. Vision is the more narrow term. But he says that he received, he was honored by God in receiving these revelations, in receiving these particular visions. He says, I don't know if it was an out-of-body experience. I really don't know. Didn't really understand that. This was something that God did to or for Paul to give him this great honor. And he goes on to say that he was caught up into the third heaven. That's in verse 2. Then he elaborates on that in verse 3 by saying he was caught up into paradise. The highest possible ecstasy imaginable for anyone. Later, Judaism talked about seven levels of heaven. Here, Paul just mentions three. The only point he's making is he went to the very throne room of God. He went to the place where God dwells. He was allowed to hear some things that men are not allowed to repeat. I don't know if that means that he could not repeat them because he didn't understand them. I don't know. It seems to be that he was forbidden to repeat what he saw. So all he says is, I was taken to the third heaven. I was taken to the very presence of God and shown some things and revealed some things that I can't even tell you. You know, we have that joke, if I told you, I'd have to kill you. That kind of thing. He's not permitted to tell others what this is. And right away, he distinguishes himself from these false apostles. It is doubtful that any of them ever received anything like that. And so he reveals this thing that was given to him. And he says, you know, I could boast about this, but he says, I prefer not to. I prefer to boast instead about my weaknesses, because weakness is what characterized him, not just as a Christian, but also as an apostle. It was in weakness that he served. The only strength he ever had was strength that ultimately came from God. But he starts out just by acknowledging that God had honored him once upon a time, a long time ago, in his work, by allowing him to go to the presence of God and seeing these unspeakable things. But then he says, in response to that, God also humbled him. He says, starting in verse 7, so to keep me from becoming conceited because of the surpassing greatness of the revelations, a thorn was given to me in the flesh, a messenger of Satan to harass me, to keep me from becoming conceited. Three times I pleaded with the Lord about this, that it should leave me. So I want to stop the reading there in verses 7 and 8. He says, now he received this revelation from God. God bestowed that on him. It's not something he went looking for. It's not something he initiated. This was something that God honored Paul with. But in response to that, God also did something else. He humbled Paul. And Paul says right at the beginning of verse 7 that this was done in order to humble him. Now, this is subsequent to his revelation. And he says, as a result of this revelation, he was given a thorn in the flesh. This thorn he describes as a messenger of Satan. And it was done with the intent of buffeting him, or this translation says, harass him. The idea of buffeting means to beat about the head. It means to strike someone. It also carries the connotation of humiliating someone. And here it's in the present tense as if to describe a chronic condition. This didn't just, this beating about the head, this buffeting of Paul, this harassment of Paul, was not just a one-time thing. It's something that continued to manifest itself over time. That's implied by the verb. So it's a constant, ongoing thing that he was never able to get rid of. Again, there's an element of shame that goes along with this. By the way, this word buffeting, it's the same word that was used to describe the beatings that Jesus received back in the Gospel of Matthew. So he said, this was given to me in order to keep me from being conceited. We don't know what the thorn was. I've read enough commentaries to know that there are dozens, and I mean dozens, of suggestions about what it was. It was obviously something that did not prevent him from traveling. This happens long before he started his missionary journeys. When I'm reading the book of Acts, I get the impression that Paul was a fairly vigorous guy. He was someone who was able to travel all over the place. You know, back in chapter 11, go back to chapter 11, in verse 23, he talks about the extent of suffering that he experienced. You know, in far greater labors, far more imprisonments, with countless beatings, often near death. Five times I received at the hands of the Jews the 40 lashes, less one. Three times I was beaten with rods, once I was stoned. Three times I was shipwrecked, a night and a day. I was adrift at sea, on frequent journeys, in danger from rivers, danger from robbers, danger from my own people, danger from the Gentiles. Now he writes that near the end of his third journey. He still hadn't traveled to Rome. Acts 27 is that whole shipwreck thing. He still has not experienced all of the beatings and the harassment that he got after he was arrested in Jerusalem, had to be in prison in Judea for 2 years, and that's before he ever gets to Rome. So he experienced a lot of stuff very early on in his ministry. These were things that he experienced to a great, great degree. So these are things that he had been stuck with for a long time. We don't know what the thorn was, though. Maybe it was the result of some of these other things. Maybe some of this other suffering triggered a chronic condition. Maybe it was an injury he received. Some think it was a particular kind of infection that he got that had ongoing effects for years to come. Some think it was a neurological disorder. Some think it was an eye disorder. I really don't know. Text doesn't really say. It was chronic, and it didn't really keep him from traveling, although he did travel with companions. Maybe that was a way of helping him along. But we don't really know what this thorn was. There are three perspectives, though, that he has of it. First of all, he calls it a messenger of Satan. So I take that as meaning that Satan inflicted him in some way. You know, you go back to the book of Job. Satan appears before God, and God takes up the challenge. He says, have you considered my servant Job? And the first thing that Satan says is, you've put a fence around him. You've put a hedge around him. You've protected Job. God says, okay, I'll take that away. Do what you want. And he takes away all of his possessions, takes away all of his family. And the second time, in the next chapter, when Satan appears before God, he says, have you considered my servant Job? Even though you incited me against him, he still holds to his faith. And Satan's reply was, skin for skin. A man will give all that he has to preserve his life. So he says, okay, take away his health. There are times when the Lord permits Satan to go after our bodies. That's what he did with Job. And apparently that's what he did with Paul. He calls it a messenger of Satan. So Satan had something to do with this physical affliction that the Apostle Paul had. But he also says it was God's way of humbling him. So on the one hand, you've got Satan's method. Think about how Satan works. Satan tries, I think, really to discourage us. If he can't get us at our ego, now that's the primary temptation I think Satan often uses. We talked about that a little bit in Bible class. And he wants us to think highly of ourselves. But if that doesn't work, I think his next best weapon is discouragement. If he can afflict you enough, if he can give you a hard enough time, you'll get sad, you'll get depressed, and you'll turn away from the Lord. And in my opinion, that's what he's trying to do with Paul. Paul was committed to the Lord. Well, let's see if I can't loosen that commitment a little bit, Satan said, by afflicting him in this physical way. So from Satan's perspective, it was an attempt to discourage Paul and get him to deny his trust in the Lord. But what was Paul's view of it? Well, we're told a little bit later on in verse 8, three times he pleaded with the Lord that it should leave me. I'm sure Paul was suffering physically and maybe even emotionally. I honestly don't know of anyone who likes to get hurt. I don't know anyone who enjoys pain. So I'm sure part of his entreaty to the Lord was, Lord, this hurts. Can you please remove it? But I think there's another thing going on too. It may be that Paul was concerned that this would affect his, that this affliction would affect his ability to do the work. Paul was very task-oriented. And I know all of us have had these afflictions from time to time that affects our effectiveness. We get worried that maybe I can't do my job quite as well as I could. You know, if I just had this different, if this was different, then I could serve a little bit better. And I think that's the perspective that Paul has. Satan's perspective is, I want to discourage Paul. I don't think Paul is discouraged. I think what he is annoyed. Yes, he's suffering, but this is getting in the way of his work. And then there's God's perspective. God takes this thing that Satan used to afflict Paul, and he says, you know what? I'm going to let Paul keep it. Satan thinks it will discourage Paul. I know Paul well enough. He's not going to get discouraged. But I don't want this to become a stumbling block to Paul by healing him and letting him get the big head. God used it to humble Paul. Three different perspectives on the same thing. This thorn in the flesh from Satan's vantage point was a way of discouraging Paul. The thorn in the flesh from Paul's vantage point was a hindrance to his work. And the vantage point of God himself was, this is exactly what Paul needs to keep him from boasting, to keep him from getting a big head. Isn't it amazing how often perspective has everything to do with the reality of our situation? What perspective do you have about your suffering? What perspective do you have about whatever illnesses you have? What perspective do you have about whatever problems that you may face? God said, I need to keep Paul humble. He is a great servant, but I need to keep him humble. And so he allowed Paul to keep this thing. Three times, he says in verse 8, I pleaded with the Lord. The answer comes in verse 9. First, God honored Paul. Second, he humbled Paul. And third, he helped Paul. How did he help him? By giving him something he didn't already have? Actually, no. He helped him by letting him keep this affliction. He helped him along by letting him keep the thorn in the flesh. And so he said in verse 9, he said to me, my grace is sufficient for you, for my power is made perfect in weakness. That was God's response to the threefold prayer of Paul. Paul, live with it. He didn't give Paul something extra. If we're reading this as saying God gave him a special measure of grace, I don't think that's Paul's point at all. When he says sufficient, he's saying, Paul, you've got everything you need. My grace, my provisions for you are already enough. You don't need anything else, Paul. In this affliction, you've got everything that you need to faithfully serve me. My grace is sufficient. And then he says, for my power is made perfect in weakness. You don't get it, Paul. You don't have to be strong with me. My power is more than sufficient to help you along in this particular circumstance. So he helped Paul along by reminding him, grace is sufficient. My grace is all that you need, Paul. In a sense, the thorn was the grace. In a sense, the thorn was the gift that Paul had that would make him rely all the more on God. You know, in this morning's Bible class, when we were talking about the temptations of Jesus, more than anything, I believe it was Beverly made the comment that Satan wanted Jesus to think he was independent of God. No. We're never independent of God. We can never do without him. And pride makes us think that we can. Sometimes it may not be a matter of pride for us. It may be a matter of despair. And we give up on the Lord thinking, well, he obviously doesn't care about me. He cares enough to give us what we need. And I think that's the point that we often miss. He cares enough to give us exactly what we need. I think it is remarkable. God wasn't concerned primarily with Paul's physical well-being. You ever hear somebody ask, well, how could God afflict innocent people? How could God make innocent babies or even adults who haven't done anything wrong? How can God be good? It's simple, because your physical well-being is not the most important thing. And unbelievers will never get that. There are more important things in your life than your health. Now, we have a hard time accepting that, don't we? You know, despite all of the problems, there are plenty of problems with the American healthcare system. There are plenty of problems. But we still have pretty good health care. Say what you will, we still have pretty good health care. And I think part of the problem is we get used to that. We get used to that, we come to expect that. And God gets a little bit further down the list on who heals us. It's not the doctors. It's not the pills. Those things may help. God may use those as channels of blessing for us. It is God who heals. It is God who has the power over life and death. And if we miss that, we've missed the point. How can God let us be sick? Because God is more concerned about greater things than our physical well-being. He's a lot more concerned about our holiness than he is our happiness. And you can have both, but you got to figure out which is the most important. Warren Wiersbe tells a story about a family that he knew. There was a family friend. It was an older woman. She had had a series of unfortunate events. She had had a series of misfortunes, devastating misfortunes in her life. First of all, her husband went blind. Second, after he went blind, he got an incurable disease. I don't know what it was. And while she was caring for him, trying to do her best to take care of his situation, their situation, she suffered a stroke. So she couldn't take care of him anymore. She couldn't work anymore. They had a lot of friends, but they didn't have any children, so they didn't have immediate family that could come and take care of them. And so it was a struggle. So Wiersbe decided to go over and talk to him, try to give her some encouragement. And he said, look, I want you to know we're all praying for you. He said, that's fine. What are you praying for? He said, nobody had ever asked him that question. Well, he said, I want you to know that we're praying for your health and your strength and that God will help you cope with the pain. And she said, that's good. I want you to ask one more thing. He said, what's that? I want you to pray that I won't waste all of this suffering. I want you to pray that I won't waste all of this suffering. What did she mean by that? It tells me that she looked at suffering as an opportunity to do something. An opportunity to do something in service to God. Do you view your sufferings as opportunities? I'm afraid very often we don't. We look at them as burdens. We look at them as I said, I think Paul's thinking was, well, if God could get rid of this, I'd be a much better apostle. No, that's not what God thought. My grace is sufficient, he told Paul. You got everything you need. How is it that we waste our suffering? We waste our suffering by seeing it as a curse and not an object of God's grace. Do you see the grace of God in your suffering? Paul had to learn that. In fact, if you go back to our text, he said, therefore, I will boast all the more gladly of my weaknesses, so that the power of Christ may rest upon me. For the sake of Christ, then, I am content with weaknesses, insults, hardships, persecutions, calamities. He broadens his scope there in verse 10 from mere physical ailment to any bad experience. In all of these things, he saw the grace of God. We waste suffering also by trusting medicine and not God. I'm not saying don't go to the doctor. Go to the doctor. Support the economy. We all need it. There's nothing wrong with going to the doctor. There's nothing wrong with seeking a medical solution. But who do you trust in all of that? Who do you trust in all of that? Is it the Lord or is it the doctors? Sometimes we go on these frantic searches for the fountain of youth. Look, you want a cure for that? Look at some of these reality shows of some of those people who've had plastic surgery about 20 too many times. It's scary. Who do you trust? Do you trust the Lord or do you trust the doctors? There's nothing wrong with going to the doctors, but there's a difference between viewing that as stewardship of the body, just being a good steward of your health. Paul said in 1 Corinthians chapter 6 that our bodies are temples of the Holy Spirit who is within us. Okay, so take care of the temple. That's stewardship. That's one thing. It's another thing to go in the other direction on this frantic search, never-ending search, for a cure, and I won't be happy until I get it. We waste suffering by refusing to even entertain the possibility of death. I think for some people, it is an effort to get past that. I don't want to die. I don't want to die. I don't want to die. You're going to die. And you got to own up to that. Another way that we waste our suffering is by grieving as if we have no hope. It's by grieving in such a way that we act more like unbelievers than anything. By going into depression. And I think I've combined 2 points there. By getting depressed about the whole situation. Paul said, I will boast about this. And here the idea of boasting takes on more the idea of joy and exultation. I am thrilled with these things, he says. Because then I get to demonstrate the power of Christ in me. We waste this suffering by not making any changes to our lives. This should draw us closer to God, does it? Does it change any aspect of our lives? If not, we're wasting that suffering. And finally, if we're not helping others, if we're not teaching others about the power of Christ in us, we're wasting our suffering. Go back to the very beginning of 2 Corinthians. 2 Corinthians, this is the opening invocation, the opening blessing. 2 Corinthians 1, verse 3, blessed be the God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ, the Father of mercies and the God of all comfort, who comforts us in all our afflictions so that we may be able to comfort those who are in any affliction with the comfort with which we ourselves are comforted by God. For as we share abundantly in Christ's sufferings, so through Christ we share abundantly in comfort too. If we are afflicted, it is for your comfort and salvation. If we are comforted, it is for your comfort, which you experience when you patiently endure the same sufferings that we do. Our hope for you is unshaken, for we know that as you share in our sufferings, you will also share in our comfort. God afflicts us, and then he comforts us so that we can help others who are being afflicted. You have a moral obligation from God that if you have suffered and been helped by him, you have an obligation to share that with others. What an opportunity, but so often we waste it. The key to understanding this text is what Paul said the Lord's answer was. There's no explanation. God doesn't say, Paul, let me tell you. Here's why I'm doing this. Here's my master plan. Here's the big map, and you're right here on this map, and in so many days you'll be here. He doesn't spell it out. He says, Paul, you have everything you need. My grace is sufficient. That's all you need. My grace is sufficient. Do you have sufficient grace for all your health problems or whatever problems you're experiencing? Do you have sufficient grace? Question. How do you know if you have accepted your thorn as God's grace to you? Someone says, well, I don't want to despair over this. I want to have the right attitude. How do you know? And I think this is the answer. When it empowers you rather than embitters you. When you can take that weakness and you draw closer to God. When you take that weakness and you see in it, not in spite of it. Now get what God did with Paul. He didn't say, okay, here's the thorn and then here's something else. No, he was working through the thorn to show Paul the grace that he had for him. So in your affliction, do you see the work of God, the power of God, the grace of God? In your affliction, does it draw you closer to him? And one other thing, and this is the hard part. Can you rejoice in that? Can you find some meaning? Can you find some purpose? And yes, can you find some joy in that suffering? That's hard. But in Christ, by his grace and with his power, we can. We can. Instead of viewing these problems as grievances, we view them as grace. Instead of asking that we be delivered from them, ask that we be delivered through them. And instead of seeing them as occasions of problems, we see them as occasions of praise. That's when you're acting on the basis of grace and you trust the Lord. I have been blessed with good health. I feel like I'm the least qualified person to talk about this because I've had pretty good health most of my life. But I've known people all of my life who have suffered greatly. There are people here in this congregation that suffer greatly with their health, and I would never, ever presume to criticize that. But we have to go back to what the scriptures say about our attitude toward these things. It is in them that we find measures of God's grace. It is in them that we find these moments of joy and strength and purpose with God's help. If you're here this morning and you've never obeyed Jesus Christ as Lord, this is what the Lord offers you. He offers you grace and strength for the taking. For those of us that are Christians, we sometimes let that slip. We get our priorities wrong. We get our perspectives wrong. Do we see the handiwork of God in every aspect of our lives and see them as opportunities for service and grace and strength? If not, we need to rethink it. We can help you in any way in your spiritual life this morning. We invite you to come forward while we stand and sing.